Today's episode, we're talking with Carol Daly. She was a lead investigator on the East Area Rapist case and was also the first woman to rise to the rank of undersheriff in Sacramento. A true pioneer for women in law enforcement, we talk about her remarkable career, how she didn't get bogged down focusing on the discrimination that she faced, investigating the East Area Rapist, consoling the victims, and catching the man. Finally, we reflect on how Sacramento has changed over the course of her time here. Thanks for joining us. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed chatting with Carol. Here in three, two, one. Thanks for joining us. It's another episode of Sacktown
nice
Talks.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Carol Daly. You were the first woman to serve as an undersheriff in Sacramento County. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. And you were also the lead investigator for the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department during the East Area Rapist.
I was one of the lead investigators on a team of people, yes.
Okay. And so I just reached out to you on Facebook because I saw a number of news stories. And I'll be honest with you, when I heard that they had caught this guy, I had to look him up. I had to look up exactly what happened.
Because you're the young generation.
Yeah, well, young-ish.
Yes.
Young-ish. That's kind of you. Thank you for calling me.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling me young. I really needed to hear that this morning. Actually, you know, age is relative because I see these kids coming out of college now. I was like, oh, you're so young.
Yes.
You know, and then you see me and it's like, oh, I'm a child still.
Well, because when I hired onto the sheriff's department, women had to be 25, men had to be 21.
Oh,
and
wow.
Now I go to an academy graduation or I see these young deputies going on, and I think, they're just kids. How can they be deputies? And so different perspective, yes.
Yeah. So let's, maybe that's a good place to start. Can we talk a little bit about how the sheriff's department has changed over time? When you were talking to me on the phone, just to get some background on this, you're saying that the opening for him was a female detective?
Right. Well,
that was like a separate category. Like, okay, female is a separate category of deputy.
At the time that I hired on the sheriff's department in 1968, it was a separate classification. It was female deputy sheriff.
Wow.
Okay. And the women had to be 25 to come on the department. The men had to be 21. We needed to be 25 because they thought we needed more life experience to be able to work in law enforcement and deal with the public. Of course, I met the age requirement because I was about 29 when I came on. And at the time they gave the test, there were only like about 15 women that were even interested. It was just the beginning of women coming into law enforcement. There were two female deputies on the department, had been on the department for 4 years, and was Joyce Pierce and Alex Cowan Magnus. And so when we applied, out of those that took the test, 12 passed, and only six ended up on the list. And so I figured, oh, I'm not going to make it because they're only going to hire one. And I don't remember where I was on the list, but it certainly wasn't number one. And John Misterly was sheriff at the time. And he said, oh, well, let's hire two. And he said, oh, what the heck? Let's just hire all six of them. And so the six women came in. We were in. And so it was kind of a fluke. I had been working as a secretary for the coroner, and my husband was a deputy coroner at the time, and he brought in the job announcement, and he said, well, look at this, and I looked at it. Well, it was double the salary, and
oh my goodness.
I had never thought about going into law enforcement. I'd always worked clerical and secretary positions, and I thought, it's double the money, I'll give it a try, and the rest is kind of history.
Yeah, yeah. What was that transition like for you? I mean, as a secretary for the coroner, you were behind the desk mostly?
I was behind the desk, I had already worked for the district attorney's office. I had worked for their domestic relations unit and did a bunch of filing, but I was able to get acquainted with a lot of the deputy district attorneys, and then...
And those would become working relationships later
yes,
on.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And then I worked for the crime lab, and when working in the crime lab, my office was a little office outside the morgue. We were located in the coroner's office, and so I set up all the procedures. The crime lab crime lab had just been established in Sacramento. Alan Gilmore was the first criminalist to come in. And so when I wasn't busy, I used to go into the lab and wash dishes and clean out test tubes and everything. And then I also was able to go in and watch a lot of autopsies because I always had an interest in medicine. And so then I also got acquainted with a lot of law enforcement officers who came in to bring evidence in from their cases. And then I transitioned to be the secretary for the coroner. And then it was after that that I took the test and went through the six-week academy. Mm-hmm. It was a daytime academy, not live-in. And our office, our classroom was the gardener shed in McKinley Park.
Oh, my goodness.
It had a, so that was our classroom. And there were six of us women, and the rest, you know, were guys that were in the class.
Did they change the curriculum? Did you go through mostly the same thing?
No, we
was there a little bit of
no. We took the same curriculum yeah. as the guys did. Our physical ability test to get in. You know, everybody has to do the physical agility, and but for the women, it was much different. And I look back, and I just think, oh my gosh, it was so funny the little things that we had to do. You yeah. know, to prove that we had the agility to be able to be a deputy sheriff.
Yeah, were they tougher on you or?
I don't think they were tougher on me. There was a lot of attitude that women didn't belong in law enforcement.
Yeah, that's. I think that this is right. what I'm sort of trying to get at.
Yeah.
What was that like, just dealing with that culture?
Well, like I said, I came from a very small town in Nebraska from the wrong side of the tracks. So dealing with people that didn't think that I belonged was just second nature to me, and I didn't care. My focus was on what I could do to pass and to become, you know, pass my probation. And I'm sure that there were a lot of different feelings on the guys. So when women were hired in Sacramento County, the female deputies, we didn't have female deputies working in the jail. We didn't have female deputies working in patrol. And so the six of us were hired on. Alex Magnus was a detective when she was the first woman, the two women hired. And Joyce Pierce was doing long-haul transportation, taking women to prisons after they had been sentenced. And so when the six of us came in, we rotated between court security, long-haul transportation, and detectives. And after 6 months, Carol Petty and I were selected to go to detectives. Now, the men, of course, at that time, in order to get to detectives, they rotated from the jail out to patrol and did their time and then had to get on a list and be interviewed to go to detectives. There were a lot of difficult feelings at the time because
you weren't taking the same pathway.
No, we weren't taking the yeah. same pathway, yeah. but there was not a pathway for us
right.
as the same as the man. And so we were able to go right to detectives.
Right, and breed a little bit of contempt or, you know, resentment or something.
I think there were hard feelings, but always it has been my
And it wasn't particularly easy. It's not like it was easier on you either way to be the first one sticking out like a sore thumb and everyone's thinking that you can't do it. It's not like that was easier on you.
No,
yeah.
but you know what? You just focus on what it is that you have to do. And that has worked for me my whole career. Focus on what I was assigned to do, what work I was given, and to do it the best that I could.
Yeah.
And after a while, the teams that we worked with, we were able to form good friendships. And once they knew that we could do the job of being a detective or wherever we worked, it was okay.
Yeah. I'll ask you to excuse me. I'm clearly struggling with some allergies this morning. That's why I'm sort of throttling my own sound in and out because I am just dying. These Sacramento springs are no joke.
I know. Everybody's had allergies.
Yeah, yeah. So you said something kind of interesting. I didn't really ask you to let's talk about this, but just as we sort of wrap our mind around ethos, and you know, you come from a different time. It seems to me like what you went through. You were really intent on not focusing on the sort of injustice of it, right? Like you're the first one.
Never.
Yeah, never, right? Do you feel like we're losing that a little bit? And this is your own, you know, this, I'm just asking you for your own personal commentary, but I mean, it sounds like you not once focused on how this wasn't fair.
I don't know that we're losing it. I think it's an individual thing. You know, how you were raised, you know, what your home life was like, and what you did to survive. So I think it's an individual thing. You either choose to be on top of everything and not let distractions interfere with what you're doing.
The reason I wanted to talk about this, I'm just kind of interested in it generally. My wife is I'm a Democrat. My wife is a Republican, mm-hmm. which is okay, actually. what I've come to realize about her and that I love about her, she's what I would call like a cultural conservative, or like a, you know, her conservatism comes from what she thinks about ethos and worldview, right? A lot of the social stuff, most of the stuff we agree on, but her thing is, I just can't focus on the injustices in the world. Mm-hmm. If I spend time focusing on how it wasn't fair for me, then I'm not going to get anywhere.
That's correct.
Because it's really tough out there. It's
yes.
really unfair.
Yes,
and if I
is.
Take my eye off the ball for 1 minute and lament the injustices in the world, lament the fact that I'm a woman, that I make less, lament the fact that I had a harder time because I got pregnant at 17, guess what? That isn't going to get me anywhere.
Right.
So, you know, for her, you know, I'm more of a let's lift everybody up. You know, I'm mm-hmm. more of a radical progressive Democrat. But, you know, I started wrapping my mind around her worldview, just saying, okay, that's interesting. You know, it's not like she doesn't acknowledge, you know, that there's challenges out there, especially, you know, for people of color, for women, for LGBT. But she just can't take her eye off the ball, you know. And it seemed like there was something very similar going on here with you as well.
I think I never, and I'm not sure why. Maybe it's because from a very young age, I always attended church and made being a Christian the central part of my life and learned to love people. And I can honestly say, from a very young age, I never felt any felt any discrimination toward any one race or any one person. And if somebody was a little different, if they were the underdog, then I always wanted to
be
their
friend. Sympathize
yes,
with them.
Sympathetic. Yeah. And so it worked well for me that I didn't have any biases against any race, religion, color, persuasion. And, you know, people are people.
Yeah.
And if I know a lot of people may have judged me, but you know what? I've never really judged people. I think it worked very well for me in interviewing suspects of crimes.
Okay.
And especially
so everyone had a blank slate.
Sure. Especially child abuse, incest, and not having any biases and treating them as a person and. And always high rate of confessions. But even in homicide, the different people that I worked with, always keeping an open mind to where they were and to what had happened and treating them with decency and respect, regardless of what they had just done, worked well for me. Being able to solve a lot of cases and have cooperation instead of coming on as a hard nose and hating people for what they did.
Right, right. Then people kind of clam up.
Yes.
What's that process like of getting someone to open up and confess to a crime? I mean, you know what they did. They know what they just did. What's that process like of getting them to verbalize it?
It is really just listening. You know, tell us your side of the story. Tell us what happened. And then always with child molesters, it was, did the victim do anything to lead you on? And then if they can shift the blame to someone else, then it's easy to say, oh, yeah, I did it, but it really wasn't my fault.
The child molester will say,
yes.
this eight-year-old
yes.
led me on?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yes.
That's insane.
So they just need, they need a way out, if you can give them a way out.
Right. In that moment, maybe looking to be understood a little
right.
bit, like, oh, if you would just understand how this
yes.
eight-year-old led me on.
Yes.
Wow. Wow. But you can approach them with decency in your heart, with non-judgmentalism. Yes. You know, well, yeah, I mean, of course you're judging them, but you can approach them with sort of, you know, as a Christian, probably with some decency in your heart and say, kind of, they can probably feel that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. They can probably feel that and say, okay, well, you know, maybe I can talk to this person now. I bet it feels good for them to get it off their chest.
It does. I think it does. I think for them to acknowledge, and even if it means they're going to go to jail or whatever. I had one case where I really took a hard-nosed approach with a man who was accused of molesting a child, and I was totally wrong. And that one situation said, I'll never do that again.
What happened?
Young girl accused a janitor at the school of molesting her. And so when I talked to the janitor, he said, I came out of the classroom and the little boy and the little girl were in the bushes playing with each other. And I said, oh, yeah. So in talking with the little girl, she was able to describe the acts and what was going on. And I thought, how does a little girl know this? And, you know, without actually being exposed to it. And, of course, the janitor said no. And I had a hard line with him. And I said, I'm getting to the bottom of this. And before this is over, I am going to see you in jail. And I said, I can't wait to make the arrest. Well, I didn't at the time because I didn't have enough evidence. In the meantime, the little girl's parents talked to her and were able to get the truth. The janitor was right. He came out of the classroom and saw the little kids toying with each other.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had to go back and profusely apologize. And he looked at me and he said, I will never forget the way you treated me. And accusing me of something I didn't do. And that was it. It only took one time for me to take a hard act. And I thought, you know what? People are people, and the truth is the truth. And I can get to the truth and still be nice and treat people with respect. And it was a conviction that God gives you.
Yeah. You know, I have this saying over and over I hear in my head. In the end, all we remember is how people made you feel.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I have been fortunate to have a career where I've had so many positive effects of people that I have arrested and people that I have worked with and victims that I have worked with.
Yeah.
And, you know, to have people come back later and say, you were good to me.
Yeah.
It's worth it.
Yeah. You know, I hear that a lot in the context of politics, because politics is such a relationship-based business. But
yes,
it's really kind of true for everything. You know, in my free time, I am I've been a martial arts practitioner,
mm-hmm.
Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Actually, one of the podcasts I run is a martial arts based podcast, and you kind of feel yourself putting those goodwill tokens in the piggy bank. Mm-hmm. Over time, you don't even, you know,
yes.
Like say, you know, putting those tokens in the piggy bank is its own reward.
Right.
I'm in the process right now of opening a Brazilian jiu-jitsu school. And so it's going to be a part-time deal. I'm just going to do 3 days a week. It'll be my own little club, but I'll charge dues and monetize my love for, you know, this mm-hmm. art that I've been doing for 15 years now.
Right.
A little bit. So in preparation for getting ready, it's EastSacBJJ, EastSacBJJ.com. But in the process of getting ready to open this, you start putting some feelers out to, you know, folks that I've coached over the years.
Yes.
And then sure enough, people start, you know, asking you questions. Hey, I heard you're opening a school, you know, mm-hmm. and then just the wave of positivity that's come back to me.
Yes.
You know, like, oh my God, I didn't realize I had touched that person and made them feel special and remembered and made them feel like they were talented even when they weren't getting it.
Yes.
And now they would like to come support my school, maybe not switch schools, but maybe at least come support it, drop in once in a while. And you realize, like, wow, over the years, you can really touch a lot of people positively.
Yes. Being positive and treating people with respect and putting yourself in their shoes, you know, so many times. I look at, you know, when you talk about people being open and being open about what you've been through and what you've experienced in sharing. And that's the interesting thing that I find about the victims of the East Area Rapists that have come forward, putting a face to the victims. They've come forward, they've been open, they've been very honest about their feelings, but they have touched hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of other people who have been have gone through the same thing and say, you know, I can recover from this.
Yeah, when I looked on, when I started looking on Twitter, you know, after they, you know, dragged D'Angelo in, I realized that there was like a whole community of victims of the East Area Rapists and victims of violent crime sort of in conversation with each other.
Yes.
Coping, supporting each other, keeping in touch. And I didn't think that there could be, I mean, you never know what might spring a community to life, you know, what might be the basis for coming together. But I didn't think that that would be a group of people that would talk to each other necessarily. Like because I'd never been through something like that, you know, so I just didn't get it. But just like, what do you know? Like they're all in conversation with each other. So yeah, can you take us through the case and sort of how you realized, that, hey, I think we've got a serial rapist and murderer in town. Because when you were saying to me, was that they didn't have a centralized clearinghouse for all these sorts of for all those sorts of sexual assault cases until much later on, right?
Right. When at the time, the Sacramento Sheriff's Department had very few specialized details. They had a financial crimes, they had a burglary unit and a robbery unit. And so if you were a detective and assigned to those units, you worked with a group of people that's, you know, you received all of those cases. Then you had your generalist detectives. We did have a youth division, which worked all of the crimes against children, you know, indecent exposure, child neglect, child molest, abuse, incest. And so they specialized in those crimes. And at the time that the East Area Rapists had started, I was assigned to the homicide detail. And the homicide detail at that time worked all felony crimes. So we worked against people. So we worked murder, attempt murder, kidnap, rape, and assault with a deadly weapon. But when cases came in, the lieutenant or whoever was assigning cases, he would screen them as they came in, and cases were assigned to whoever had the least caseload at the time, you know, so, you know, to kind of even things out.
So it's like whoever's pile on their desk was the smallest.
Mm-hmm.
Here you go.
Yes, that's right. And so the first East Area Rape victim that I encountered was Jane Carson. She was victim number 5. And we realized this was a different rapist than any other rape case I had ever worked because of his method of operation. And we had had, by this time, officers were starting to talk and they said, oh, this sounds like my case. Oh, this sounds like my case. So we put the cases together and realized that we had a serial rapist working.
Yeah. All the officers, like in a bullpen, kind of like just kind of walking through their cases.
Oh yeah, because we were all located on the same floor, and they were open offices, and so people walking back and forth, and you know, you were talking, and yeah, we didn't necessarily have briefings together. But
how long do you just to be clear about this? If you had all had one centralized unit for sexual assault cases, you'd be comparing all these cases to each other in real time.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And that wouldn't come until later on.
Right.
So how long do you think he was allowed to operate without folks realizing that, hey, this was a serial rapist?
I think it was about Jane Carson, about 4 rapes in.
4 rapes in.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a couple of years?
Oh, no. Just months.
Months.
Yes.
Okay.
Very short time.
Yeah. See,
Weeks, maybe. Yeah. So at the...
Wait, so he was getting people every other week or something like that?
Oh, yes.
See, I didn't know that. I mean, I guess I could have constructed the timeline, but I didn't really realize like how heavy that must have been. Sacramento's a smaller town back then.
Sacramento was a very small town. Sacramento was always referred to as the little big town because it was a big town. We had two Air Force bases. We had the Capitol. So we had a lot of government workers, a lot of civil service workers, but it was still a small town feel.
You got this guy getting people every other week.
So you have this rapist, and maybe he would go a month or so in between. But at the time we realized that we had a serial rapist going, Dwayne Lowe was the sheriff at the time, and he said, okay, I'm pulling all of my most experienced investigators together, and we're going to form a team, and you're going to catch him, and as soon as you catch him, then we're going to do a big press release saying we've caught a very bad rapist. That wasn't happening. Yeah. We weren't able to catch him right away. And it wasn't until one of the directors of Livermore Laboratories, his daughter was going to Sac State here, and he had gotten wind just through talk that there could be a rapist on the loose in Sacramento, and he was afraid of his daughter's safety. So he came in to made an appointment with Sheriff Lowe and brought a couple of businessmen with him and said, okay, here's what we hear. And if this is the truth, the public has to know. They have to know how to protect themselves. And Sheriff Lowe said, you're right. So he said, after that, every time we have a rape, we're going to announce it in the papers. And that just fueled the fear in the community. It was a good thing, but it fueled the fear in the community because every time the rape came out, it was rape number 6, rape number 7, rape number 8, rape number 10, rape number 13, rape number 15. And
in a small town.
In a small town.
Oh my God.
And we had two newspapers.
And they were
grisly.
I mean, his method of they were just awful, right?
They were the worst rape cases that I had ever worked. And I had worked a lot of heinous crimes. But his MO was different, and partly because his MO was to terrorize and to demean and to degrade, to maintain control and to put fear in a victim for the rest of their lives.
Wow. And he was killing people at the same time too.
Not here in Sacramento.
Not here in Sacramento.
No, we knew before he left Sacramento that he was working himself up to kill somebody. We really felt the next call that we got was going to be to a homicide scene where he had killed his victim.
I thought he would break in and like rape the wife and kill the husband. That wasn't...
In Southern California.
In Southern California.
But all of those... in Southern California, there were 4 couples, but both of them were murdered. And then there were 2 women alone who were murdered. So he eliminated any possible witness.
How was he allowed to evade capture? How was he able to evade capture for so long?
Well,
you usually get your guy, right?
When we were in the midst of the investigation, we felt that it could be somebody who had law enforcement experience, was very schooled in
methods of operation and detection
and how
and stuff
to
like that.
How to conceal evidence and what to look for we thought at one time he could have been in the military, he could have been a law enforcement officer. And of course, our worst thoughts that could he be a law enforcement officer? Turned out he was. He was both military and law enforcement, had a BA in criminal justice with Sacramento State. So he was very well schooled in how to get away with a crime and what officers were going to look for when they arrived at the scene.
What do you look for, and what weren't you finding?
Well, we weren't finding fingerprints.
Okay.
And we, at one of the crime scenes, there was a drop of blood that was not the victim's. And so we had that analyzed, and we're actually using that for a lot of elimination of the suspects. So we had a shoe size, we had a height, and we had a weight, we had a sound of his voice. And he always wore a ski mask, always wore gloves. His body was always concealed. The composites that we had were from people who had seen somebody at the crime scene of the Majori Werder's homicides. But we didn't know how good that was going to be. And so we had not a lot of evidence to go on. He had a rare type of, well, w- I don't know if it was his blood or not. Okay. So the person that had the blood that was found at the crime scene was an A with a 1-1 PGM factor, which means they were a non-secretor. So it was more of a rare blood type. And so we were using that blood type to eliminate probably 95% of the suspects that we were encountering.
But it didn't help you actually find your guy?
No. I mean, when you look back, 40 years of investigation, all of the ups and downs, all of the suspects, all of the good leads, all of the high hopes that we had that we'd finally arrested, you know, finally we're going to identify who the East Area Rapist was, none of them came about. And as we look back now, I mean, we weren't even...
You weren't even close.
He never even came on our radar. Here he was.
Who did you have on your radar?
Oh, thousands of suspects.
Yeah.
I mean, right after the press conference 2 years ago, more than 200 tips were called in. We eliminated over 5,000 or 6,000 suspects in that 2 year period that I worked the East Area Rapist. And so, you know, every mother, not mother, but every girlfriend, you know, that had a boyfriend that was weird, every wife that had a husband that was weird, every neighbor who had a neighbor they thought were weird, they were calling in names.
Hey, I think this is the guy.
Yeah. Some of them we could eliminate because of size. You know, we knew he wasn't 6'3". You know, we knew he was about 5'10". And so some of them we could eliminate for size. We went...
Okay, so getting a bunch of tips like that, maybe not necessarily super helpful. Because then you're looking
no,
for needle in a haystack?
Well, because you have to look through them real fast. Yeah. To you can run and see if they had a criminal history. You look at, you know, their physical description. And then sometimes we had to just eliminate people by sitting on their house after a rape occurred to see whether or not the person was home or whether he was on his way home.
Oh, goodness. Wow.
But the thing that really worked for in to his advantage was that he stayed in the homes for so long, sometimes 2 and 3 hours. And he would toy with the victim after they were tied up, and he would go in the kitchen, he would eat something, he'd walk outside, he'd come back in, he'd drink a beer. But he and the repeats, the assaults were repetitious. You know, he may do his sexual acts more than once with the same victim. And so every time the victim would start to move, he'd say, I'm right here, don't move, I'm going to kill you. And so there was such fear of being killed that it took sometimes 30, 45 minutes after the rapist had left the scene before they felt safe enough to move and to try to get untied and to try to get help. And so by this time, he's gone out of the area. You know, officers, patrol cars converging on the scene, doing neighborhood canvassing and checking the area.
And he's long gone.
He's gone. He's nowhere around.
So actually staying in the house for a while really helped him. Really helped sort of condition the victims, frankly, too.
It conditioned the victims to never knowing when he had left.
Oh, my goodness.
Because he was, by the time he was left, you know, they thought he was gone. He was right there. And it was like he was watching them, waiting for them to move so he could just put more fear
into
them.
So he could mess with them.
Yes.
That's really awful. So, I mean, his thing was really just terrorizing people.
It was terrorizing people, having control, and abusing them. I always thought that instilling the fear and having control and transferring his hate onto the victims was really his primary goal.
Yeah. Why was he traveling to do his acts? Was that just to evade capture? He murdered folks down in Southern California.
Okay. Anytime that you have a criminal that crosses boundaries, okay, we had actually, out of all of the rapes, there were 27 of them in Sacramento County. Okay, when he started out, he was in the East Area. And we had a B reporter, Warren Holloway, who was just the great guy. You could tell Warren anything and say it's not for public. And he'd always honor that. He was such a great guy. So he was listening to a group of detectives talk, and he was looking at where the rapes were occurring. And he said, those are all in the East Area. And so the guy was dubbed the East Area Rapist. Well, then he moved across the river. He was in Rancho Cordova. He moved to South Sacramento. did three rapes in the city of Sacramento. So once you cross law enforcement boundaries, you complicate an investigation. He ended up going to Stockton, to Modesto, down to Contra Costa County.
There's some speculation that he was the Visalia ransacker.
There's talk that he could be tied into being the Visalia ransacker, who was a burglar who, you know, went into homes and
burglarized like 15 homes, something like that.
And sometimes a rapist will start his career by just prowling or being a window peeper, a peeping Tom, and then it just isn't enough. And so the next thing he has to touch and he has to feel.
Oh my goodness. So it's like this gradual escalation.
Yes.
So that's what they say, like if you see a child being cruel to animals, this is sort of like one sign, right?
Oh, yes. Anytime you see a child being cruel to anybody or anything, you know, it's an alert sign that something is wrong and you need to correct it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you have here? You have old papers from the investigation?
Oh, no, these were just some of the things that we did.
Okay. Walk us through it.
Some of the things everybody... When I look back, everybody said, is there something you missed? There was nothing that we missed in order to identify who the East Area Rapist was. We used every tool available to us at that time. And so remember, we're working at a time when information is coming to law enforcement agencies through teletype. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have radios in our cars. We had pagers where we had to stop and, you know, the department could page us and there'd be a phone number. And once in a while, there'd be a 911 after it, which meant get to a phone as soon as you can. We had old typewriters. We didn't even have electric typewriters yet. And we had, you know, we did all of our own reports. We weren't recording them and having somebody else transcribe them for us.
Is that what they do now? They transcribe the reports?
Yes, they can. Yes, dictate and they're transcribed by a secretary.
That's cool.
Yes. And we didn't have a lot of things available to us, but even in the community, you know, you didn't have all of the homes weren't as alarmed as they are now, although they did get a lot of alarms during the time the rapist was working. But you didn't have a lot of the street lighting. You didn't have all of the cameras. Oh, my goodness. I would love if we'd have had all of the cameras on the street that we have now, because I think we may have been able to see someone. So you just didn't have the modern technology that you have now. Our biggest source of elimination was having people chew on a piece of gauze to determine what their blood type was. And if it wasn't a type A blood, you know, then we could eliminate them. And the 290 registrant list, you know, we went through everybody that had ever been convicted of a sex crime.
Yeah, 290 is sex crime.
Sex crime, yes. Yeah. If you've been convicted of a sex crime, you register as a 290 registrant. So, I mean, we looked at all of those. We had the specialized team. Once we realized that we had a rapist going, the task force was set up. So we had an investigative team that responded, and that was several investigators converged on the scene. And my primary responsibility was talking with the victims. And then the other officers would be interviewing the husband or any other family members and talking with anybody else that could have been a witness. You had CSI team, and it was the same people. So regardless of what your shift was, if there was an East Area Rape went down, you were an investigator, you got called. If you were a CSI team, the same CSI team went. And because once you get used to what the MO is and what you're looking for, it was much easier for the crime scene investigators to know, you know, what to look for and points of entry and footprints and things like that. Then you had a canvas team that was canvassing the whole neighborhood. Then you had a tactical response apprehension team, and those were officers in unmarked cars that were riding around in the neighborhood. And
ready to catch the guy
trying to catch the guy so they wouldn't be suspicious if it was a squad car. So everybody was working in concert with each other and sharing information, you know, within our jurisdiction.
One of the things that you said to me when we talked on the phone was that this was never a cold case.
This has never been a cold case.
You would think after 30 years, it'd be a
it leads tips coming in on this case have been coming in all through the year. So they always had an investigator at the department that was following up on the leads. But you also had a group of detectives, officers on the department who had retired and formed a team and decided on their own they were going to continue following and trying to identify who the East Area Rapist was. And one of those
What does that come out of, like a sense of duty, a sense of
it was a case that affected every person in the department. Didn't make any difference if you were a dispatcher, if you were a patrolman, you were a detective, you were CSI. Everybody in the department, the East Area Rapist was for 2 years absorbed everything in that department. And so if you were on the department at that time, you'll talk to dozens of officers that said, I worked the East Area Rape case. Yes, they all did. There was so much fear in the community. I mean, the patrolmen were taking it. When are you going to catch that guy? How come you haven't caught that guy? You know, what are you doing to make this a safer community? So there were a lot of things that we had to do at the time to educate the community on how to be safe. We had community meetings where people came to hear about what the East Area Rapists did because
frightened out of
their
skins.
They were so afraid, and you know, rumors were just rampant. And so we wanted to make sure that we had as much information out there in order for people to protect themselves. There was nothing that we did not do. We had officers laying in ditches, officers in treetops with surveillance cameras and night scopes and things. We did it all to try to identify him.
He just stopped doing this? He just stopped? Is that...
He left Sacramento County and went to outlying jurisdictions to the Bay Area. And then next thing we knew, he was down in Southern California. But you know what? We didn't connect the East Area Rapes to the homicides down in Southern California until 2001, many years later.
Okay. So you would all, in the department, the mood of the department was over time. He moved out of town. He just quit doing this. He's doing this, but somewhere else.
Well, things just kind of got back to routine law enforcement. Yes. We had no idea that he was down south doing, you know, the homicides.
Yeah. Yeah. And then other things start taking your time and attention.
Yes.
Wow.
No, after 2 years, once we realized that he had left the jurisdiction, I asked to go back to homicide, and I said, because I was continuing to do all of the follow-up, you know, leads and everything, we were doing search warrants, we were still active doing investigations, and I said, I don't want to work this anymore. Mentally and physically,
just get tired of it.
I was drained. The emotional support of working with victims that you had no answer for, you couldn't bring closure to. And I said, I want to go back to homicide. And my captain said, well, there's a lot of stress in homicide. I said, but we have closure. Back then, we were solving 98% of our homicides. And, you know, you had closure. And with all of these victims,
wasn't a victim to console, right? Or, I mean, well, I guess the surviving
families.
Spouse.
Sure, sure. You had your families that, but there was closure for them, you know. And all of these years, the victims of the East Area Rapists had never had closure until D'Angelo was arrested.
That's the toughest part, you think, is the lack of closure?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think for any crime, the lack of closure, not knowing who, why.
Wow. You you must have seen any number of other grisly and remarkable things in your time in the sheriff's department.
Sometimes people don't think of crimes being grisly, but when you see children who are beaten, children who are molested, and when there's incest and things in the family, to me, those are really grisly crimes, because when a child is so young and is a victim of a crime, it scars them for the rest of their life. And homicide, yes, I work some very interesting cases. I work the Davis sweetheart murders, where the young couple out of Davis who were kidnapped. And it was years later that case was solved with DNA. I just testified in court about 3 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And that man is, Hirschfield, is sitting on death row right now. I worked Richard Chase, the vampire killer. So these are probably, these are cases that you don't even probably remember hearing about.
No, no. My wife knows all about them. She's a true crime. I guess there's a true crime convention.
Yes.
Out in Nashville or something.
Yes.
She's looking at taking us next year. My wife knows all about this. So I kind of got interested in this. And then when they caught him and I saw Twitter explode over this, I was like, oh my goodness. I mean, the long arm of the law, you know? And the way that they caught him too is positively, I mean, just amazing.
You know what? A lot of people may, and I've received, you know, accolades and say, oh, you know, you did a good job back then. But you know what? The real heroes of this are people like Paul Holes, people like the sergeants and the detectives who are currently working in the sheriff's department that have spent hours and hours and hours making it their point to try to identify who the East Area Rapist was.
Yeah.
Sergeant Ken Clark, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of old reports he poured through trying to hope to find a name. And we just look at all of the work that was done over 42 years, and nobody was even close. But it had to be done. We couldn't give up.
Right, right. So just for folks listening, my understanding of how they caught, and I'm sure it's more technical than this, but just to attempt to give folks an understanding of how this went down, they took the DNA that was collected from the East Area Rapist, and they submitted it to like Ancestry.com and said, hey, who are the possible matches? Right, and it pinged his family members.
Okay, I can't go there because I was not a part of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I know just exactly what you know of what I've read in the paper.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then so just for folks listening, I think that's my understanding of it. I am going to invite Paul Holes on. I'll bet that his schedule is probably packed right now, but we can see if we can get any more insight into it than that. But my understanding is that that's basically what happened. You would you like to care to comment on the state of law enforcement in Sacramento today? Yeah, I mean the town has changed. We're dealing with a much more urbanized environment. You've recently seen calls for community policing. That's really more of a SAC PD thing. With everything that's going on with the Stephon Clark, I get the sense as society has changed, policing has changed too, right?
I think law enforcement currently is it's a calling. It's a profession. Sure, some people get into it for the money and realize that, you know, the money isn't worth it. You know, they don't want it. But I think there is still a lot of very personal satisfaction for officers on police forces today. There's so much good work, and it's unfortunate that, you know, there are cases that come to the attention that that blindside all of the good that officers do, the lives that have been saved, you know, the crimes that have been solved and people put behind bars to make other people safe. I think it's a more difficult profession. I've talked to a couple of people in law enforcement, and they said they wouldn't want their kids going into law enforcement right now because of what is happening. You can argue it either way.
Yeah.
You know. So I think it's more difficult. I was just thinking back to when I started in law enforcement, I would work Sundays. Okay, Sunday mornings are typical. All right, this was when I went to detectives. Our typical Sunday morning was you go in and you get maybe one or two cases assigned to you. I mean, we were following up on every obscene phone call, every missing person at the time when I started doing investigations. They were all investigated. I mean, now,
you're lucky
if you can get an officer to come to your home. So,
I had read recently San Francisco had 30,000 smash and grab car break-ins last year.
And they can't investigate them all.
30,000.
Right. Yes.
30,000.
Yeah. You
know? I was just in San Francisco yesterday on doing a photo shoot, producing a commercial for a client. And the photographers that we had contracted to do this were like, you know, I'm going to park my van right on that red curb. And if they give me a ticket, they give me a ticket. But, you know, I mean, he'd read the same report that I, you know, there's 30,000 smash and grabs. I got right. my livelihood in this van.
Yes.
You know, I guess that's what I was trying to get at in terms of policing now, policing today, crime today. One of the things that I had read in my criminal justice class back in college, but this is the one little nugget that really stuck with me, was that the, you know, a couple of things happened in society in the, you know, from the 90s to the 2000s to the 2010s that have really sort of like encouraged criminal behavior. One of them is the rise of personal electronics. So now you have something that's, you know, 3 inches by 5 inches and it's worth $1,200. Where, you know, back in the 80s and the 70s, you didn't have something that valuable, that small, that you could just kind of pickpocket, or you could just kind of steal, or you could just kind of break into a car. And so the money behind, you know, small acts of petty crime is actually a lot larger now because of the rise of consumer electronics. Two, you know, this is not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, but I think it's a good thing, but there's more women in the workforce now, right?
Yes.
And that used to be your neighborhood watch, right? Was if you had, and there's a number of reasons there's more women in the workforce. I think a lot of families just financially with what rent and what housing costs now, they couldn't afford to have, you know, one person stay at home. It used to be you could work 40 hours and one person could stay at home. You know, and you can live in decency. Now, two people working 40 hours is barely enough to get by.
No, the cost of living. But, you know, when you talk about women in the workforce and Neighborhood Watch, and as a sergeant, I worked in community resources, and Neighborhood Watch was our big contact. In essence, it was community policing. You know, we had our small group of people, and once a month we would go into the community and we would have meetings and talk to them about safety and different things, you know, how to keep their homes safe. So in essence, that was kind of how community policing got started. Well, then there was the big push for community-oriented policing, where officers actually are assigned to a certain area, and that was their area of responsibility. So if there was different kind of crimes going on, they would be aware of it, and they could, you know, be more in touch with the citizens, who were more apt then, because they knew the officer, to call and give information. And so community policing, it's still in effect, and it's an excellent tool. Yeah. You talk to any department, and community policing is the buzzword, because it works when you work in concert with the community and they have a trust with the officers on, you know, on the beat with them. They're more apt to share information and give information.
Again, this is sort of the discussion I was hoping to have. The concept of community is a bit more amorphous now too, right?
Well, you talk with a lot of people, and they get up in the morning, they go to work, and they come home. They don't know who their neighbors are.
Exactly. Yeah.
They, and especially if you're in an apartment complex where you have a lot of transients, you know, I don't mean street people, but you have—
No, but they come for 3 years.
They come for sometimes 6 months, you know, maybe a year, and they're gone, and people don't really get to know each other.
Yeah.
That was a lot of what Neighborhood Watch was, in street block parties, to try to get people out and get acquainted with each other.
Yeah, I guess this is sort of what I was trying to talk about. Was, so as society has changed, sort of like the ability for communities to police themselves has changed. I just got finished reading a book, and I talk about it over and over again, probably because it's the only book I've read in a while. I just wish I had more time. It's called Coming Apart by Charles Murray. He's talking about sort of like the change in American society over time, and particularly the unraveling of the social compact within white America as measured from 1960 to 2010, right? And at the end, he kind of pulls the lens back and he says, well, this is happening in all America, right? So he had a number of sort of points that are actually kind of proven statistically in the book. And one was the decline of social capital. And that is measured in sort of, do you know your neighbors? You know, they had this like a general attitude survey that one of the universities sends out to like tens of thousands of Americans. And they've been doing it for decades. So you can actually kind of measure how people's attitudes change over time. And so social capital is, you know, if you twisted your ankle, do you have a neighbor who'd mow your lawn for you?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, in the 1950s, everyone Everyone had a neighbor that had mowed their lawn for them. Mm-hmm. You know, social capital is, do you know someone in a 3-block radius that you could, you know, drop your kids off for an afternoon? And it, you know, and just, you can watch the graph just plummet after, right around after 1980s, right? And a number of things happened, right? One of the things that happened was people started going to college. You know, I believe in college. I don't want this to get twisted and say I don't believe in the American university system. But it used to be that marriage was sort of like the stick that was turning the melting pot, right? When everyone started going to college, or when many people started going to college, college-educated people started marrying amongst each other. And then non-college educated people started marrying amongst each other, and then their kids, and their kids, and their kids, and their kids. So then you have these two tracks of American society, the college educated and the not college educated, kind of really bifurcating. Over time, the folks that with college educations and then, you know, graduate degrees started retreating into what Charles Murray calls the super zip codes of America. And so he mapped out something like the 10 wealthiest zip codes in American society. Mm-hmm. And they were all at least 15 miles away from the urban city core, and many of them are behind gates now. They're literally just separating themselves from society, right? And that has effects, I think, you know, in community policing, where it's like people are just, you know, interacting with, they're creating communities online, mm-hmm. as opposed to creating communities in the geographic location in right. which they live. And so this idea of, hey, you know, community, won't you be our partner in keeping eyes and ears on the ground? Won't you be our partner in, you know, calling your friendly neighborhood officer? Well, I mean, God, what community? Mm-hmm. What community? Another sad thing that he points out in the book, and this breaks my heart, but I kind of tend to think of it as probably true. One of the questions in this general survey of American attitudes was, how much do you trust your neighbor or the people that live around you? Mm-hmm. And what do you know, but in neighborhoods that are predominantly white and like in culturally homogenous neighborhoods, mm-hmm. like if it's all white folk in the neighborhood, white folk will say, yeah, I trust other white folk. If it's all blacks in a neighborhood, black folks will say, yeah, I trust other blacks. You know, like if the neighborhood is ethnically homogenous, way more likely to trust each other. But as we started diversifying, that trust within the neighborhood actually started declining. And that's just sort of like unfortunately innately in us, you know? And so that idea of like, oh, trust your neighbor. It's like, well, this is, you know, we've got some real challenges, you know?
I think, you know, just listening to what you were saying, going back to when I came into law enforcement, you could have a high school education or your GED. And a lot of guys coming into law enforcement were coming from the military. I mean, back then, almost every deputy had a military background, and it was kind of a natural transition for them to go into law enforcement. You know, it was here, protect and serve. And now, you look at people in law enforcement, and even a lot of the departments are required that you have a AA, but you, and most of them, you have to have a bachelor's. I look at people in the department, they have masters and they have their doctorate. And if you don't have an education, it's even hard to get promoted and to get ahead because you're competing with people, you know, who have that. So yes, that, you know, that has changed in almost every career, you know, your experience, your experience counts, but it's your education combined with that experience that is going to get you ahead. When you talk about neighborhoods, we've lived in our home for 49 years. It was an old home. It was all we could, you know, it was all we could afford to find at the time. We were, husband and I were newly married. So it's a court. And so there are about 8 or 9 families on the court. It's a Portuguese community. And so two of the families.
Are you Portuguese?
No. Okay. No. Okay. No,
I kind of had you pegged for like Italian Catholic or
I don't know. You know what? My husband did his DNA, and of course he's 85% Irish. Our last name is Daly. He's right. John Patrick. You know, his father was John Patrick Daly. My DNA kit is still sitting on my desk. I haven't sent it in yet, so I'm not sure what all I am. But we have three black families, Portuguese families, and then the white families. Most of the neighbor families have been on the court the whole time that we have been there. We've seen two of them, ladies have widowed. They're still living in their homes. And everybody helps each other. We're out. If we see something, you know, we're always watching out for each other. One of the homes is vacant, and so we're, you know, it's ready to go up for sale. Yeah. So, and now...
And you're hoping someone comes in.
We just had a young family move next to us that just had a young child, and it's the first little kids that we've had on our block in a long time. The other family that had moved in, and they have lived there ever since their children were just toddlers. And she's now a deputy sheriff with Sacramento Sheriff's Department.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah.
How tender.
Yes. So you have to be in a neighborhood for a long time, but we know everybody on that court. Do we know the people on the street behind us? Do we know the people across the street? No, we don't know any of those, but we know our little
pocket.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that let me talk about that sort of like buying into a neighborhood, right? Like I bought this house 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm. This is a great neighborhood.
This is a great neighborhood, Talloc Village. So I, one of the things that I did, if you're interested in sort of becoming an amateur historian, you pull the paperwork for your house.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And it was, this house was, this is Talloc Village subdivision number 4. And I get the sense that this was all at one point army housing, because these are all the same layout.
Yes.
Here. And it's all mm-hmm. old cinder block, right? And it was envisioned, I think, in 47, annexed in 49, and built in 50. Okay. And the house belonged to R.C. Willis and his wife. And his wife had the name on the deed too, but she just signed Mrs. R.C. Willis. Mm-hmm. In 1952, she signed Mrs. R.C. Willis. This is what I love about pulling up those old documents. He has funny L's. You know, they're just kind of like really big and loopy.
Uh-huh.
You know? Then they did this back room that we're in right now. They did this like in 73 or so. And again, they signed the permit for the back room. R.C. Willis and Mrs. R.C. Willis. And then in 87, they put in the covered patio over there. And again, she signed Mrs. R.C. Willis, you know, Mrs. So I actually don't know what her first name is. I would love to know who she is, you know?
Every home has an interesting history. Our home was originally owned by the Seamus family that Seamus Avenue is named after.
Oh, wow.
And it was the original horse riding stables and blacksmith shop. It was way out in the country. And my husband, as a child, used to come to the horse stable and ride horses for like 10 cents a day or something. And so then, you know, it was a library and it was a rest home, which got closed down. And we have, it's interesting because we still have our patio of 120 feet is all still covered with all the old railroad ties and heavy that used to be the horse stables.
Oh, wow.
And so it's just an interesting piece of property, but interesting history. But it had been, then a bunch of hippies had lived in it and just literally destroyed the inside of it.
As hippies will do.
Yes. And so it had been vacant for a couple of years. My husband and I had having come through divorce and paying child support and everything, we didn't have much money. And the bank said, if you will buy this house, we'll pay to have it all paid. We'll give you the money to paint and put carpet and everything in it.
Oh my
goodness.
Said,
well, this is a good deal. My husband, fortunately, is able to, he can do electrical, he can do plumbing, he can do construction, he can lay cement. So he's a jack of all trades on top of being a deputy sheriff.
That's so cool.
Many of them were in that day. That's
back
how
in the
they
day,
earned extra
you can work
money.
With your hands,
right.
Yeah.
And so we were able to, it's been 49 years of working on that home. We're still working on it.
You know, when I bought into this neighborhood, I love this. I love this neighborhood. I love the Raley's just right down the street, you know. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was an interesting exercise in what my sort of cohort of friends my age thought about coming to this neighborhood.
Right.
And so, you know, my initial price point was like, oh, I'd love to buy a home under 250,000, mm-hmm. maybe 300, love to buy somewhere around there, you know? And so in that price point, I had, you know, I was a little bit priced out of Midtown unless I wanted to live in a shed, right? I could go to Natomas. Mm-hmm. I could buy a condo in Natomas, but I have, you know, 800 square feet. But you're in Natomas, you're in a planned community. You're with other people that wanted to live in a planned community, right? Or I could come down to South Sac. You get a lot more square footage, but you're in South Sac. And I get why people might not necessarily want to feel like, oh, well, I got to go to Natomas or I got to go somewhere else. I heard bad things about South Sac, but, you know, I mean, a number of things happen when you start sprawling out communities. One is you let people sort of separate themselves instead of, you know, get your butt down to South Sac and help lift this community up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a bad community, but I'll have my friends who went to Natomas, and nothing against you folks that went to Natomas, nothing against you folks that, you know, went to a planned community. I totally understand and respect the reasons why you would do that. But, you know, just how quickly you lose touch is a little bit disheartening. I had a friend come over for like a barbecue. And they come and says, hey, great house, beautiful interior, love what you did to the backyard. Oh, I don't know about some of the neighbors. So I was like, what do you mean you don't know about some of the, you know, I'm just saying to myself, what do you mean you don't know about some of the neighbors? You mean Wolf down there? He's working on his car. It's a rough neighborhood because you got a guy working on his car in a tank top. Guess what? That's how people used to, you know, he's about 7 years old and he's having fun monkeying around with his car. Why is that bad? You know,
right.
But there, you know, that can work on your car. I could never imagine. Right. So I've found it an interesting exercise in what people who come here think about this neighborhood.
Well, you know? Typically, when you move to Sacramento, the north area has been, you know, Carmichael, Fair Oaks, and American River, and all these beautiful homes. And then you cross the river into South Sacramento. And it was like when I grew up on the wrong side of the tracks. I lived on the south side of the tracks.
Yeah.
And I lived in the north area, North Sacramento, just a very short period of time. And then when I got my divorce, I moved into South Sacramento. And I like it. But growing up, all of the entertainment, the good restaurants, movie theaters, almost all of them were in the north area. You had to travel there. And so it's been interesting. And now I don't think it's as much a stigma to the younger people because we have so much to offer in the south area. You look
That's
at our
beautiful.
Communities,
I like it.
You know, you look at Laguna, you look at Elk Grove, my goodness, Elk Grove at one time, they didn't even want a fast food restaurant in there. And now look how much they have grown and all of the festivals and the different things that they have. So yeah. It's a matter of choice of where people live.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it. We're at a little bit over an hour. Is there anything else that we left out of the discussion? You think that's good?
I don't know. It went completely in a different circle than I thought it would go. So it's just been fun talking to you.
Yeah,
thanks.
Great. Thank you.